Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. On February 14, 1989, that is to say Valentine's Day, the Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran placed a death fatwa on Salman Rushdie. This was in response to the publication of his novel, The Satanic Verses. For the next decade, Rushdie was forced into hiding under the protection of the British Secret Service. In 1998, the fatwa was eased and Rushdie emerged back into public life. The following year, Literary Arts hosted him on the stage for his first public appearance in Portland ever. He joined us on the occasion of the publication of his novel, The Ground Beneath Her Feet. What is fascinating about this talk is that Rushdie essentially deconstructs the novel for us, discussing how he came to the central ideas of the book and created an enduring work of literature around those ideas. In 2016, Iranian media outlets raised $600,000 to reinforce the long-standing fatwa to kill the novelist, adding to the existing $2.8 million that had already been offered. So Rushdie remains in the shadow of this threat to this day. The Satanic Verses serves as a testament to the power and to the danger of books. That Rushdie has continued to write and fight for free speech serves as a model of artistic and democratic engagement in our civic life. And after being surrounded by so much danger for so long, it is remarkable that Rushdie's sense of humor is so healthy. Here's Rushdie in 1999.
Thank you. Well, welcome to the gig, I guess. I have to say, you don't want to hear me sing. Trust me. However, I do, there's a lot of you here, and it makes me feel that I shouldn't be up here by myself. I should probably have a couple of guitarists and some girls going, ooh. And I suppose if this was a rock concert, I should, especially since I've never been to Portland, I should say things like, how are you doing, Portland? All right. I'm not going to do that. One thing I can't expect is, because I had been to Seattle once before, I was able to tell them a story of how the previous time that I was there, somebody offered to marry me. And then she showed up again last night in Seattle. And when I told the story, she shouted out, I'm still here. I guess the night is young, so... let's just see how it goes. One of the things I'm going to do during the course of the evening is change glasses a lot so that I can read to you bits of the book, and you will have to consider this to be what passes for dramatic action in the next hour. So to begin with, to tell you about The Ground Beneath Her Feet, I thought I'd read you just a small passage. The novel is about three people. Two of them, Ormus Karma and Veena Apsara, are singers, and they get together and form a band called VTO, which becomes very successful. And in fact, as we all know, it was in fact the most successful group in the history of rock and roll, and came from Bombay. Completely plausible proposition. Either that or it's fiction. Early in the book, the third character, the narrator, is a photographer called Rai, who is kind of in love with both of them. And as I guess, and like his author, in love with song. And he has this to say on that subject. Why do we care about singers? Wherein lies the power of songs? Maybe it derives from the sheer strangeness of their being singing in the world. The note, the scale, the chord, melodies, harmonies, arrangements, symphonies, ragas, Chinese operas, jazz, the blues, that such things should exist. That we should have discovered the magical intervals and distances that yield the poor cluster of notes, all within the span of a human hand, from which we can build our cathedrals of sound, is as alchemical a mystery as mathematics or wine or love. Maybe the birds taught us, maybe not. Maybe we are just creatures in search of exaltation. We don't have much of it. Our lives are not what we deserve. They are, let us agree, in many painful ways, deficient. Song turns them into something else. Song shows us a world that is worthy of our yearning, and it shows us ourselves as we might be if we were worthy of the world. Well, thinking about a love story of singers, I made a note in my notebooks years ago, actually, I mean, when I was still writing The Moor's Last Sigh. There's a page in an old notebook where I've written in extremely large, excited letters the words Orpheus, rock and roll, yes, and then lots of exclamations and underlinings. So I clearly thought I'd had a good idea. And what it meant was that, rather unusually for me, when I finished The Moor's Last Sigh, instead of having what normally happens to me, which is a fairly extended fallow period while the tank refills, I more or less plunged straight into this because Orpheus Rock and Roll Yes came back to me and insisted on turning into this book. Why Orpheus? Well, he's a singer, but also because the thing that I wanted to do most of all was to write a love story, and to find a way of writing a contemporary love story that was neither gushily sentimental nor fashionably cynical, but which could face up to great passion and try and make sense of it. And so, in my usual perverse way, while trying to write a modern story, I found myself thinking about an ancient myth. Because the Orpheus myth, the story of Orpheus and Eurydice, is, well, it seemed to me to be just about the most powerful, if not the greatest, the most powerful love story ever told, because it suggested that there was such a thing that we could experience as a love that lasted beyond death. And that in the story, these three great facts of our lives, music, love, and death, are very tightly united. And depending on which way you turn the prism, they mean different things. And you could look at it optimistically and say that what the story tells us is that the lover, through the agency of song, overcomes death. Or you could look at it tragically and say that death, by overcoming the power of the artist, destroys love. And like any great myth, you don't have to choose between those meanings. It means all those things at once. And that attracted me to it. And then thinking about Orpheus and thinking, well, I seem to have got myself a singer, and he seems to have this mythological antecedent. Now what? Because then I had to choose what sort of music the book would be about, and it was at this point that I really thought that, because I did want the book to be about the modern, I wanted it to be about the world as it's been in the last 40 or 50 years. To be frank, I didn't want to be stuck in an opera house. Even though, I mean, in a way, it would have been natural to take the Orpheus story into an opera house, because it's been there so often before. The first three operas ever written, the operas of Monteverdi and Jacopo Peri and Gluck, were all Orpheus operas, and after that comes Telemann and Offenbach and so on. And I mean, it's been a repeated theme of opera, but I've always been uneasy in opera houses, even though I like opera, you know. I prefer to be on the street outside, and so that's where the rock and roll part of Orpheus Rock and Roll Yes came in. And I found myself wanting to write about the music which I grew up with, the music which was young when I was young, which grew older with me, and which now people are beginning to say is almost old-fashioned. It's an extraordinary thing if you think about it. Something really amazing happened in around the late 50s, early 60s, which is that the music of that period, which is now, you know, 40 years old, still feels pretty contemporary. Whereas if you were standing in some 1955 at the time of the beginning of rock and roll, and you went 40 years back from there, and you looked at the music of, you know, 1915, it would seem as if it came from the Stone Age. So something happened there, which was the invention of a music that became a popular lexicon, which in many ways we're still using. And I found, as a writer, to be able to set that modern lexicon, that modern frame of reference, which we all share, and to which I could make very glancing references and be confident that the readership would pick them up. I found that really quite like the way in which a 19th century writer would have been able to use a classical frame of reference and make glancing references to the myths and to the great books, and expect that his readers would pick them up. Now, in this book, when making mythological references, I had to explain more, you know, because for obvious reasons we don't share that culture anymore. So to contrast that previous universal frame of reference with the contemporary universal frame of reference became, for me, one of the most interesting aspects of writing the book. However, if one can be as daring as to criticize one of the great myths, it seemed to me that there were some, let's say, holes in the Orpheus story, which meant that I couldn't actually use it as a straightforward model, but only as a sounding board. And these holes mostly have to do with the character of Eurydice. Because actually she's hardly there. You know, we don't know anything about her. All we know about her is that at the beginning of the story, she and Orpheus get married. We don't know where she comes from. We don't know what her background is. We know that she's a wood nymph. That's it. And all we know about her is that she then is pursued by another man and fleeing from him, steps on a snake and dies, and then he goes down to the underworld to try and get her back, doesn't get her back, end of story, you know, end of Eurydice anyway. And she's a blank slate. Certainly there's nothing in the myth which suggests to us why it might be that Orpheus would love her so much that he would wish to follow her beyond the gates of death. There's nothing in the myth which tells us what an extraordinary woman she must have been in order to inspire such a love. So I thought, well, no help there, I thought, you know. So I had to start. So in fact, the character of Vina in the novel more or less owes nothing to the myth. I mean, indeed, in my humble view, fills in slight absence in the myth. But there we are. The author of the myth is no longer around to answer back. And so I get away with it, really. I got into a lot of trouble in England when the book came out, and people asked me why Vina was so aggressive and loud-mouthed and badly behaved and oversexed and generally appalling. And I made the mistake of saying that I'd always been attracted to bad girls. And it's got me into a great deal of trouble, not least at home. So now I feel the need to add in my books. I think if you look at those books, you'll see that there's a fair supply of loud-mouthed, appalling, bad girls, who I seem to find, you know, come to me more naturally than demure, quiet women, probably because I don't know many of those. As for my personal tastes, I guess you'll never know. The other thing about the myth that I worried about was that there was a kind of imbalance of action in the myth, in the sense that Orpheus does everything, Eurydice does nothing, except step on the snake and die. And I thought that wasn't what I wanted either. I wanted the two characters to be much more in balance with each other, and so I changed things around. I mean, in a way, I wanted them both to be Orpheus. I wanted them both to be Eurydice, so that in the novel, although Ormus is the one who writes the songs, she's got a better singing voice than him. So that part of the genius of Orpheus, you know, is hers rather than his. And also, there's a point in the novel in which she rescues him. I mean, there's a point in the novel in which he is involved in a car accident and is for a time in a coma, and it's her voice, the sound of her voice, that brings him out of that, if you like, underworld. So they're both involved in the business of bringing each other back from the dead. I mean, an interesting thing was that when I was thinking about the book, I recalled that in Indian mythology, there is something quite like the myth of Orpheus, except that it is the other way around. I mean, it is a myth in which the woman rescues the man. And in Indian mythology, this has to do with an incident between the gods, where the god of love, Kama, as in sutra, you know, an athletic god. Kama decides to play a trick on the great god Shiva by shooting an arrow of love at him and forcing him to fall in love with some unsuitable wench. Shiva, being Shiva, sees the arrow coming and deflects it, and angry with the god of love, unleashes a thunderbolt, which fries him, you know, reduces him to ash. Love, therefore, has been killed by Shiva, and it falls to Kama's wife, Rati, to beg for forgiveness and to beg with Shiva to restore her husband, love, to life, and eventually he does. And so through the agency of Rati, love comes back to life. So it is kind of more or less the opposite of the Orpheus story, including a happy ending, which the Orpheus story doesn't have. In a way, I mixed up those two myths and put in some flavoring of my own, and the book came out of that. Moving on from the myth, there's a third point to the triangle. The narrator, Rai, who entered the novel in a strange way, because originally I hadn't thought he'd be there. Originally I'd thought that I was simply telling this love story about Ormus and Veena. And then when I came to write it, well, I'd always known that Veena, as I was saying before, would be unfaithful. I mean, she's colossally, hideously unfaithful with anything that moves. And I always knew that she would have a particular lover, a kind of backdoor man. And I originally thought that maybe he would either be a minor character, or he'd be off stage, or he wouldn't necessarily have to be an important figure. But he marched on stage for the reason that I came to feel that because Ormus and Veena become very famous, and they become kind of sacred monsters, and they rather inflated, gargantuan figures of our time, that it might become difficult for readers to retain sympathy and interest in them when they became these much larger than life figures. And if I were to see them from the point of view of a person who was, in a way, obsessed with them both, who was obsessed with Ormus and in love with Veena, that his deep connection with them would maintain ours. You know, that was what I thought. And so Rai walked on and began to tell the story, and then became for me, in many ways, the discovery of the novel. While I was writing the novel, there occurred this the extraordinary events that followed the death of Princess Diana, and I noticed that suddenly the profession of my narrator had become the most hated profession in the world. And that for a time, anybody who picked up a camera professionally seemed to be treated with a kind of scorn and contempt and hatred, and as if every photographer was a paparazzo. You know, Cartier-Bresson was a paparazzo, Richard Avedon was a paparazzo, you know everybody. People were actually booing and hissing when they saw professional photographers. And that made me think further about the business of photography and what it is to walk up, you know, into the world's face and take its picture. Rai is he's a very opinionated chap. During the course of the novel, he has...
You're listening to Salman Rushdie, a Literary Arts, the Archive Project. If you missed any part of this episode, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Stay with us. More from Rushdie is coming up.
The novel begins with an earthquake in Mexico. An earthquake, in fact, in the first sentence, it's giving nothing away to tell you that Veena dies in this earthquake. And that's, in a way, her descent into the underworld. The earthquake is in the town of Tequila in Mexico. But I was very surprised actually to discover that there was a town called Tequila. You know, I mean, there isn't a town called Whiskey. You know what I mean? Or gin or vodka. It seemed very odd that there should be a town called.
I'm Andrew Proctor, and this is Literary Wine, Arts, the Archive Project. Let's rejoin Salman Rushdie.
And rather a large chunk of the Pacific coast of Mexico as well. And then I had to go to Mexico sort of at the new year, and I had to do press conferences and things. And I remember apologizing in advance to the Mexican press for having destroyed their country or a large chunk of it, and they told me that it was all right and not to worry about it, which I thought was very generous of them. Not sure that I would have been so generous if they'd destroyed my country, you know. Anyway, so Rai here is in the aftermath of the earthquake, during the earthquake, is running around the town with his cameras. And he says that somehow he has this ability when taking pictures to shut out everything except what he's seeing through the lens. And so he says when he remembers this, as he tries to remember the exact sequence of events, he says, "I find that my memory has become a silent movie. I remember only silence," he says, "the silence of great horror. The silence, to be more exact, of photography, because that was my profession, so naturally it was what I turned to the moment the earthquake began. All my thoughts were of the little squares of film passing through my old cameras, Voigtlander, Leica, Pentax, of the forms and colors being registered therein by the accidents of movement and event, and of course by the skill, or lack of it, with which I managed to point the lens in the right or wrong direction at the wrong or right time. Here was the eternal silence of faces and bodies and animals and even nature itself, caught, yes, by my camera, but caught also in the grip of the fear of the unforeseeable and the anguish of loss, in the clutches of this hated metamorphosis, the appalling silence of a way of life at the moment of its annihilation, its transformation into a golden past that could never wholly be rebuilt. Because once you have been in an earthquake, you know, even if you survive without a scratch, that like a stroke in the heart, it remains in the earth's breast, horribly potential, always promising to return, to hit you again with an even more devastating force. A photograph is a moral decision taken in 1/8 of a second, or 1/16, or 1/125. Snap your fingers, a snapshot's faster. Halfway between voyeur and witness, high artist and low scum, that's where I've made my choice, made my life, making my eye blink choices. That's okay. That's cool. I'm still alive, and I've been spat at and called names only a couple of hundred times. I can live with the name calling. It's the men with the heavy weaponry who worry me. And they are men almost always, all those Arnolds carrying Terminators, all those zealous suicidists with their toilet brush beards and no hair on their baby naked upper lips. But when women do such work, they're sometimes worse. I've been an event junkie, me. Action has been my stimulant of choice. I always like to stick my face right up against the hot, sweaty, broken surface of what was being done, with my eyes open drinking, and the rest of my senses switched off. I never cared if it stank or if its slimy touch made you want to throw up, or what it might do to your taste buds if you licked it, or even how loud it screamed. Just the way it looked. That's where, for a long time, I went for feeling and truth. What actually happens? Nothing to beat it when you're pressed up against it, as long as you don't get your face torn off. No rush like it on Earth. Well, what happens in Tequila in the earthquake is that the vats in the tequila factories burst, and the liquid begins to flow. The streets were like whips, snaking and cracking. The Angel Distillery was one of the first to succumb to this lashing. Old wood vats burst open, new metal buckled and split. The river of tequila made its frothing way into the lanes of the town. The leading wave of the torrent overtook the fleeing populace and turned it head over heels, and such was the potency of the brew that those who swallowed mouthfuls of that angelic surf came up not only wet and gasping, but drunk. The last time I saw Don Angel Cruz, he was scurrying in the tequila-drowning squares with a saucepan in his hand and two kettles on strings slung around his neck, trying pathetically to save what he could. This is how people behave when their dailiness is destroyed, when for a few moments they see plain and unadorned one of the great shaping forces of life. Calamity fixes them with her mesmeric eye, and they begin to scoop and paw at the rubble of their days, trying to pluck a memory of the everyday, a toy, a book, a garment, even a photograph, from the garbage heaps of the irretrievable, of their overwhelming loss. Don Angel Cruz turned panhandler was the childlike, fabulous image I needed. I began to shoot. I don't know how long all this took. Asked me to put an estimate on it, and I'd come up empty. 20 seconds? Half an hour? Search me. My trick of switching off my senses and channeling all my powers of perception through my mechanical eyes, this has, as they say, a downside. When I'm facing the enormities of the actual, when that great monster is roaring into my lens, I lose control of other things. What time is it? Where is Vina? Who's dead? Who's alive? Is that an abyss opening beneath my combat boots? What did you say? There's a medical team trying to reach this dying woman? What are you talking about? Why are you getting in my way? Who the fuck do you think you're trying to push around? Can't you see I'm working? Who was alive? Who was dead? Where was Vina? Well, there are answers to those questions, but they're later in the book. The thing to say about Rai is that he's rather a flawed fellow. He actually makes his name by doing something really quite, I suppose, bad would be the simplest way of putting it. I mean, he is on an assignment in rural India, and he finds a fellow photographer who's been investigating the same political scandal, and the photographer has been killed. And in the heel of his boot, he finds a roll of film which provides the evidence of the scandal, and he takes it back to the city and claims that he's taken the pictures. And that's what makes his name as a photographer. So he begins in that very morally ambiguous way, and also, of course, he spends a lot of the novel trying to break up the relationship of Ormus and Vina, because he's in love with her too, and you could say that that was a bit reprehensible. And I must say that as a result of all this, it is a little trying when journalists ask me if he's autobiographical, which, trust me, they do. I've almost decided to start answering this question alternately in opposite ways. Yeah. To tell one journalist that, yes, actually, I did all these terrible things, and tell the next one no. And I suspect that these interviews would appear on the same day in the same town in different papers, and nobody would notice the contradiction. You know? So, anyway, I'll carry out this test and report back. Rai, however, does in a way improve through the novel, and in a way, I mean, at the end, without giving it away, he does find himself a kind of joy. He becomes a part of what you might even call a happy ending, which is, I use the term carefully, because people who know my writing will know that's not a familiar thing to find at the end of one of my books, and I've often thought about my characters, that they probably didn't know what they were letting themselves in for when they signed on. You know, that it might have seemed like a good job when they got in. You know, oh yeah, Rushdie novel, sure. But then, it's hell after that for most of them. But Rai does improve, and he does actually end pretty happily. So that's a first for me, more or less. I wanted just to go on about his his um, his opinionatedness, because it was a great thing for me to have to discover a narrator who had so much to say for himself and who had so many opinions about so many things and would just take off into these riffs which managed to get said things that, you know, that I'd often thought and never quite managed to get said. All the three characters leave India. They all start off in India and they all go west. And so the idea of being an outsider, the idea of outsideness, is important in the novel. And needless to say, it's something about which Rai has views, which are these. He says, for a long while, I have believed that in every generation there are a few souls, call them lucky or cursed, who are simply born not belonging, who come into the world semi-detached, if you like, without strong affiliation to family or location or nation or race. That there may even be millions, billions of such souls, as many non-belongers as belongers, perhaps. That in some the phenomenon may be as natural a manifestation of human nature as its opposite, but one that has been mostly frustrated throughout human history by lack of opportunity. And not only by that. For those who value stability, who fear transience, uncertainty, change, have erected a powerful system of stigmas and taboos against rootlessness, that disruptive antisocial force, so that we mostly conform. We pretend to be motivated by loyalties and solidarities we do not really feel. We hide our secret identities beneath the false skins of those identities which bear the belongers' seal of approval. But the truth leaks out in our dreams, alone in our beds, because we are all alone at night, even if we do not sleep by ourselves. We soar, we fly, we flee. And in the waking dreams our societies permit, in our myths, our arts, our songs, we celebrate the non-belongers, the different ones, the outlaws, the freaks. What we forbid ourselves, we pay good money to watch in a playhouse or movie theater, or to read about between the secret covers of a book. Our libraries, our palaces of entertainment tell the truth. The tramp, the assassin, the rebel, the thief, the mutant, the outcast, the delinquent, the devil, the sinner, the traveler, the gangster, the runner, the mask. If we did not recognize in them our least fulfilled needs, we would not invent them over and over again, in every place, in every language, in every time. No sooner did we have ships than we rushed to sea, sailing across oceans in paper boats. No sooner did we have cars than we hit the road. No sooner did we have airplanes than we zoomed to the furthest corners of the globe. Now we yearn for the moon's dark side, the rocky plains of Mars, the rings of Saturn, the interstellar deeps. We send mechanical photographers into orbit or on one-way journeys to the stars, and we weep at the wonders they transmit. We are humbled by the mighty images of far-off galaxies, standing like cloud pillars in the sky. And we give names to alien rocks as if they were our pets. We hunger for warp space, for the outlying rim of time. And this is the species that kids itself that it likes to stay at home, to bind itself with, what are they called again, ties. That's my view. You don't have to buy it. Maybe there aren't so many of us after all. Maybe we are disruptive and antisocial and we shouldn't be allowed. You're entitled to your opinion. All I will say is sleep soundly, baby. Sleep tight and sweet dreams. Well, Veena is certainly an outsider. She's she is, as you'll see when, as I hope you read the book, she's had a terrible childhood. She's had a brutal childhood full of violence, and as a result it's become very difficult for her to trust. And she feels, when she does reluctantly give her trust, she feels once again betrayed several times. And so this makes a problem in her love of Ormus. And it showed me something extraordinary writing the book, which is that this kind of great love, this kind of grand passion that they have, is something slightly separate from ideas with which we normally surround love. I mean, ideas such as fidelity, such as trust, such as durability, such as even happiness. Because she's in a way afraid of the size of the thing that's between them, and I mean, in a way, so is he. And they keep trying to spoil it for themselves. They keep quarreling and breaking apart and coming back and bouncing off each other again and swearing crazy oaths not to go to bed with each other and so on and so on. And it's as if the thing is too big for them to avoid, but also too big for them to have. And it's certainly not solid ground. You know, it's certainly not reliable. It's not trustworthy. It's not stable because it keeps exploding in their faces. It doesn't that much make them happy. And yet, there's nothing to call it except love because of the depth of the connection between them. And I thought that was a rather extraordinary discovery, that you actually can strip away all these comfortable things that we think about love and find out that the real thing, the thing without all these soft clothes, is actually a much more animal, savage thing, a wilder thing, you know, and scarier. And that's what I, in the end, found myself writing about. Around their love story, however, there's a large kind of social context, apart from the musical context. And a lot of that has to do with their journey from India to America. Veena actually is half American. She's born in Virginia, and then she goes east to India as the poor relation and gets farmed off on local relatives. And then she and Ormus end up back in America later. And I guess you could say the book also talks about a movement from the time of the British Empire in the middle of the century to the time of the American Empire at the end of the century. Ormus's father is very, early in the novel, is very seduced by Britishness and by British civilization and culture. Ormus and Veena, in their way, are very seduced by America. And I just wanted to read you a bit of what Veena thinks about that, because in this, I mentioned the car accident. After Ormus wakes up from the car accident, I mean, this has happened in England, and she tries to get him, when he wakes up and he's feeling better, not to dally in England, but to go with her rapidly at high speed back to New York. She says to him, "Ormus, you got stuck here, but it was an accident, and you're not stuck anymore. You can either stay and, I don't know, immigrant the rest of your life away. And let's not forget immigratitude. That's expected too, along with immigroveling. Or you can cross the mighty ocean and leap into that old hot pot. You get to be an American," she says, "just by wanting. And by becoming an American, you add to the kinds of American it's possible to be. That's in general I'm talking about, okay, and New York City in particular. However you get through your day in New York City, well then, that's a New York kind of day. And if you're a Bombay singer singing the Bombay bop, or a voodoo cab driver with zombies on the brain, or a bomber from Montana, or an Islamist beardo from Queens, then whatever's going through your head, well, that's a New York state of mind. Of course, there are Americans you'll never be," she goes on. "Boston Brahmins, slave owners' sons from Yoknapatawpha County, or those sad sacks on the daytime confession shows, fat men in check shirts sitting with fat women showing too much thighs, wearing their naked subtitles and baring their clumsy souls. Just because they do not remember their history, it doesn't mean Americans don't have it, or that they're not doomed to repeat it. You'll never have that stuff, that's for sure. But you don't need it. You'll say things all wrong, but they'll at once become American ways of saying things. You won't know shit, but it'll right away become an American type of ignorance. Not belonging, that's an old American tradition, see? That's the American way. You'll never be a child in Virginia, Ormus," that's what she was. "You'll never see your mama swinging in a barn, but you've got horror stories of your own. And you don't have to do this, but if you want to, you can pretend. You can start arguing in bars about the Yankees pitching rotation or stressing over the Mets. You can play Remember When, that's as in Remember When the Brooklyn Dodgers, or Runyon's Broadway, or The Village of the 50s, or The Birth of the Blues. It's like when you have a leg sawn off and you still feel it twitch, only it's the opposite. You can start feeling the twitching of legs you never had. And guess what? If you pretend long enough, then baby, it becomes a good old American pretend. You can walk on those pretend legs without even crutches, and they'll carry you wherever you're going, because what do you know, half the country's faking it just like you, and the other half isn't, but there's no way to tell which is which. So you get your strength back almost, you hear what I'm saying, and then you take up thy bed, and you don't just walk, you f***ing fly out of here with me. America starts today. So there are earthquakes all over this book, and for fairly obvious reasons, really. Earthquakes in this world in which the characters move all over the place, in which their love is uncertain, in which life is uncertain. Earthquakes, as Rye calls them, are geology as metaphor. In the middle of all this uncertainty and provisionality, there's a moment at which I wanted to say, and Rye said it for me, that this isn't just a literary device. It isn't just something that happens in the book. It seems to me that the world that we live in is uncertain, provisional, and metamorphic in this way. Not because the ground shakes all the time, but because we're constantly being asked day after day to accept very radical redescriptions of what was true yesterday. And so, in a way, the ground is not certain beneath our feet. And there's a moment when, just Rye's last riff, when he talks about this. This is what he has to say. The world is irreconcilable, he says. It doesn't add up. But if we can't agree with ourselves that it does, we can't make judgments or choices. We can't live. The contradictions in the real have become so glaring now, so inescapable, that we're all learning to take them in our stride. We go to bed thinking, just a random example, that Mr. N.M. or Mr. G.A. is inhabiting a particular cold, wet lump of godforsaken rock, our vile devil worshippers swigging blood and sacrificing babies. The next day, it's as if nothing of the sort ever occurred. The leaders of whole countries vanish as if they never were. They're miraculously erased from the record, and then they pop up again as talk show hosts or pizza pluggers, and they're back in the history books again. Certain illnesses sweep across large communities, and then we're told that no such illnesses ever existed. Men and women recover memories of having been sexually abused as children. Whoosh, no they don't. Their parents are reinstated as the most loving and laudable people you could imagine. Genocide occurs. No, it doesn't. Nuclear waste contaminates large swathes of entire continents, and we all learn words like half-life. But in a flash, all the contamination has gone. The sheep aren't ticking anymore, and you can happily eat your lamb chops. The maps are wrong. Frontiers snake across disputed territory, bending and cracking. A road no longer goes where it went yesterday. Mountains rise and fall. Well-known books acquire different endings. Color bursts out of black and white movies. Art is a hoax. Style is substance. The dead are embarrassing. There are no dead. You're a sports fan, but the rules are different each time you watch. You've got a job. No, you don't. That woman powdered the president's Johnson. In her dreams, she's a celebrated fantasist. You're a sex god. You're a sex pest. She's to die for. She's a slut. You don't have cancer. April Fool. Yes, you do. That good man in Nigeria is a murderer. That murderer in Algeria is a good man. That psycho killer is an American patriot. That American psycho is a patriot killer. And is that Pol Pot dying in the jungle or merely Noel Knott? These things are bad for you. Sex. High-rise buildings, chocolate, lack of exercise, dictatorship, racism. No, au contraire. Celibacy damages the brain. High-rise buildings bring us closer to God. Tests show that a bar of chocolate a day significantly improves children's academic performance. Exercise kills. Tyranny is just a part of our culture, so I'll thank you to keep your cultural imperialist ideas off my f***ing fiefdom. And as for racism, let's not get all preachy about this. It's better out in the open than under some grubby carpet. That extremist is a moderate. That universal right is culturally specific. This circumcised woman is culturally happy. Pictures don't lie. This image has been faked. Free the press. Ban nosy journalists. The novel is dead. Honor is dead. God is dead. Ah, they're all alive and they're coming after us. That star is rising. No, she's falling. We dined at 9. We dined at 8. You were on time. No, you were late. East is west, up is down, yes is no, in is out, lies are truth, hate is love, and two makes five, and everything is for the best in this best of all possible worlds. Well, that's what the earthquakes really are. There's some fairly tragic stuff in this book, but it's kind of a tragedy told in the form of a comedy, you know. And so, sort of as a final set of remarks, I wanted to talk about tragedy, which leads me to the subject of goats. Well, you may not see immediately the connection. And nor did I. But then I discovered, this is the problem of only having half a classical education. I learned Latin but not Greek. And so sometimes I have to stumble on the Greek. And I discovered, to my amazement, that the word tragedy comes from the Greek word for goat. That, in fact, the word tragedia, the Greek word, comes from the word tragos, a goat. And therefore, tragedia, a goat song. Now, why were tragedies called goat songs? It's all very simple, really. It's because when these great plays were performed in antiquity, in classical Greece, they were always preceded by the sacrifice of goats to the god Dionysus. And so the tragedia was the piece of entertainment that happened after the main event, you know, after the goat sacrifice. So I thought, well, if what I'm doing, in effect, is telling a goat song, singing a goat song, then I'd better put some goats in it. So this is a novel in which there are quite a lot of goats. Some of them exist, and some of them don't. The political scandal that I mentioned, about which Rai finds the other photographer's film, you know, is known as the Great Goat Scam. And India being India, you can't make up the best stuff, you know. I mean, it's simply you just pick it up off the street and tone it down a bit to make it plausible. So there was a scandal not unlike this. Well, what happens in the novel is that there's a bent politician who's a sort of feudal landlord as well, and his scheme for making money is to set up very large goat farms all over the sort of rural areas of India. And on these goat farms, there's just one snag, which is that there are no goats. Now, the non-existent goat has a number of advantages over the actually existing goat. For a start, it requires many less people to look after it, so your labor costs are low. It also doesn't require very many people, it doesn't require a very large expense in terms of foodstuff, fodder. So that's a saving too, and then of course the government gives subsidies to farmers who run exemplary goat farms to government standards, and those subsidies, although very small in themselves, when you multiply them by millions of goats and many years, actually become very large sums of money, and the government happily pays this money. And the only problem, of course, is what happens if the government discovers that the goats don't actually exist. Which can be solved in India by the thing that solves everything in India, namely bribery. So along comes the government inspectors every so often, and you bribe them. You know, and they duly fill in the forms which say that the goats exist. And to this, I mean, actually, the real version of this, which wasn't about goats, it was about cows, but I thought goats were funnier, did actually go on for a long time in India. And as I say, I just picked it up and turned it into goats, and there it is. But it's this great goat scam made hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars for the character of the novel who does it, and actually in many and no doubt for the real life politician who, with his version. So anyway, I had to find out a lot about goats, and I have to say it's the first time that I've ever managed to do any serious research on the internet. For instance, some of the goats are in America, in the novel, and I didn't know a great deal about goat farming in rural Virginia. I have to say, this was not one of my subjects. You know. But such is the internet now that you can actually get onto the websites of each individual goat farm in Virginia, and be told by them exactly what they do. You know, so I now know an enormous amount about goat farming in Virginia, much more than I ever expected to know, and I'm now trying to forget it. however, I do take credit for one joke about goats. Goat jokes are almost as plentiful as drummer jokes, but this one's mine, and if anybody else has heard it before, leave now. Well, it's in the book, but I'll tell you anyway. It's in the sort of rural Virginia part of the novel, and you have to imagine that two goats break into the projection booth at the local drive-in and start to eat the movie. And after a while, the first goat says to the second goat, "So, what do you think of the film?" And the second goat says, "Yeah, I mean, it's quite good, but I thought the book was better." Thank you very much.
That was Salman Rushdie speaking at Portland Arts and Lectures in 1999. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. The show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.